Welcome to the Audio Renaissance unabridged presentation of The New Psycho-Cybernetics, written by Maxwell Maltz, MD, edited and updated by Dan S. Kennedy and the Psycho-Cybernetics Foundation, Incorporated. Produced by John Baker. Final production supervised by Tony Hutz. And read by Paul Michael. We begin The New Psycho-Cybernetics with this introduction by Dan S. Kennedy. The year 2000 was the 40th anniversary of the publication of Dr. Maltz's original Psycho-Cybernetics. The book has sold over 30 million copies in all of its different editions worldwide, inspired a number of audio cassette programs for individuals, as well as complete training programs created for corporations, sales organizations, even sports teams. In the 2000 Olympics, for example, the coach of the U.S. equestrian team used psycho-cybernetics techniques, as she has with other teams for many years. In many ways, psycho-cybernetics is the original science of self-improvement. I make that statement for three principal reasons. First, Dr. Maltz was the first researcher and author to understand and explain how the self-image, a term he popularized for certain processes within the subconscious mind, has complete control over an individual's ability to achieve or fail to achieve any goal. Second, everything written, said, recorded, or taught about self-improvement since Maltz wrote has derived from his work. Try and find any book on success or self-improvement written since 1960, right through to yesterday, that does not include a discussion of self-image and the techniques for improving and managing it, notably including visualization, mental rehearsal, and relaxation, and you'll realize how crucial the work of Maltz still is. The relatively young science of sports psychology, relied on heavily by professional golfers, sports franchises, coaches, and Olympians, owes an enormous debt, occasionally acknowledged, to psycho-cybernetics. Third, unlike philosophical musings about success, psycho-cybernetics is, in fact, scientific. It provides practical things to do, not just think about, that yield quantifiable results. What is unique about psycho-cybernetics is that it offers techniques that help make whatever was once difficult, easy. In short, whether you set out to lose weight and keep it off, lower your golf score, double your income in selling, become a confident public speaker, write the great American novel, or achieve any other imaginable goal, in order to succeed, you will use psycho-cybernetics techniques, either directly from Dr. Maltz or some other source influenced by his work. By acquiring this program, you have gone to the first and still foremost source. It is significant that, with very little publicity or marketing, the original Psycho-Cybernetics book has had such amazing longevity and is now a classic in its field. Today, just as 10, 20, and 30 years ago, sales managers tell recruits, coaches tell athletes, consultants tell clients, get and read this book. Now I dare to update the classic. In doing so, I have set out to preserve much of the original content. Much of it, in fact, is unchanged. Some has been modestly updated in language or example. To integrate it with other works of Dr. Maltz, I have added my own observations and lessons learned from teaching psycho-cybernetics techniques, along with examples and stories submitted by many users of these techniques and culled from others' books referencing these techniques. Throughout, I have tried to maintain Maltz's original voice. Over the years since 1960, Dr. Maltz and those who followed him devoted increasing emphasis to translating the principles and concepts of psycho-cybernetics into actual, practical mental training exercises, and I've included a number of those as well. All things combined, this is the most complete psycho-cybernetics work ever published. My own experiences with psycho-cybernetics began in childhood, when I used it to conquer a stubborn, rather severe stuttering problem. I've gone on to enjoy a 20-year career as a professional speaker, in recent years addressing audiences as large as 35,000 and in total over 200,000 people annually. In adult life, I returned repeatedly to these techniques in my sales, consulting, and business activities to assist me in my prolific writing career, 9 published books, a monthly newsletter, over 50 different audio cassette programs, and as an advertising copywriter, my primary vocation. For example, Using psychocybernetics, I am able to give my subconscious mind certain instructions and put it to work on a writing assignment before going to sleep at night or taking a nap. Wake up, instantly put fingers to keyboard, and download. Pour out what the subconscious wrote while I slept. Not long ago, I climbed into a sulky and became a harness racing driver at age 46 and found myself relying heavily on psychocybernetics. In my business life, I have worked with many millionaire and multimillionaire entrepreneurs, including some who have risen from poverty or financial disaster, and others who have started from scratch and rapidly built empires. Most of them use these techniques. Many trace their understanding of them directly to Dr. Maltz, as I do. I first began working directly with psychocybernetics as a writer, editor, and publisher in the late 1980s. At the time, I worked with Dr. Maltz's widow, Ann Maltz, and a university associated with her to develop a collection of audio tapes featuring Dr. Maltz's lectures, radio broadcasts, and interviews. Since then, I've been directly involved in the first book ever written featuring psychocybernetics specifically for salespeople, titled Zero Resistance Selling, an audio program, the new Psychocybernetics book on tape programs, a 12-week home study course, and a monthly newsletter, as well as special editions of programs for certain professions, industries, corporations, and international translation. My point is that I've lived and worked with and benefited from psychocybernetics my entire life. I was told by Ann Maltz that she had difficulty telling my writing on this subject apart from her late husband's. That was an enormous compliment. I hope she was right. And that this expanded and updated version of the original comes across to you seamlessly in one voice, Dr. Maltz's, as if he were here to prepare it himself. If you have comments, I would enjoy hearing from you via fax at 602-269-3113 or mail care of the Psychocybernetics Foundation, 5818 North 7th Street, Suite 103, Phoenix, Arizona 85014. If you'd like to read back issues of the Foundation's newsletters, you may access them at www.psycho-cybernetics.com. I sincerely believe that you hold in your hands one of the most powerful tools for self-improvement and goal achievement available anywhere, at any time, at any price. It has been my privilege to have a small part in bringing it to you. If you aren't achieving everything you want in life, it is probably because your goals are being ineffectively communicated to or rejected by your self-image, and your servo mechanism is underutilized and uninspired. This statement may initially strike you as psychobabble and gobbledygook, but by the time you listen to this program just once, you will fully understand that this single statement reveals the master key to all personal achievement, including whatever improvement in performance and outcomes you desire in any area of life, personal, health, relationships, career, business, or finance. Dr. Maxwell Maltz died in 1975, yet he is the primary author of this program, written in 2001, and he contributed in a very active and lively way. In addition to writing the original Psychocybernetics on which the new edition is based, Dr. Maltz was a remarkably prolific researcher and writer. By the time of his death, he had written over a dozen books and three complete courses of study on different aspects of psychocybernetics, thousands of pages of unpublished counseling session notes, interviews, speeches, and radio broadcasts, and more. All of this material was put into a computer, carefully sorted and organized, so that Dr. Maltz could continue contributing to new works even today. Although Mr. Kennedy has also contributed to this program, to prevent confusion and clutter, you are hearing everything spoken by one voice, Dr. Maltz's. It reads as if Dr. Maltz wrote it today, in its entirety. We are certain he would be proud of this work, and that you will benefit from it enormously. Chapter 1. The Self-Image, Your Key to Living Without Limits. Bruce Barton wrote, "Nothing splendid has ever been achieved except by those who dared believe that something inside them was superior to circumstance." A revolution in psychology began in the late 1960s and exploded in the 1970s. When I wrote the first edition of Psychocybernetics in 1960, I was at the forefront of a sweeping change in the fields of psychology, psychiatry, and medicine. New theories and concepts concerning the self began emerging from the work and findings of clinical psychologists, practicing psychiatrists, and even cosmetic or so-called plastic surgeons like myself. New methods growing out of these findings resulted in dramatic changes in personality, in health, and even in basic abilities and talents. Chronic failures became successful. F students changed into straight A pupils with no extra tutoring. Shy, retiring, inhibited personalities became happy and outgoing. At the time, I was quoted in the January 1959 issue of Cosmopolitan magazine, in which T.F. James summarized these results obtained by various psychologists and MDs as follows. Quote, "Understanding the psychology of the self can mean the difference between success and failure, love and hate, bitterness and happiness. The discovery of the real self can rescue a crumbling marriage, recreate a faltering career, transform victims of personality failure. On another plane, discovering your real self means the difference between freedom and the compulsions of conformity." Unquote. This was barely predictive of everything that has occurred in the four decades that followed. When Psychocybernetics was first published, if you visited a bookstore to obtain a copy, you might have found it nestled on an obscure shelf with only a dozen or so other so-called self-help books. Today, of course, self-help is one of the largest sections in the entire bookstore. Psychologists, psychiatrists, and therapists have proliferated. New specialists have emerged, such as sports psychologists and corporate performance coaches. And the stigma of seeking such help has disappeared to such an extent that in some circles doing so is trendy. Self-help psychology has become so popular it even has found a place in television infomercials. Once difficult, now easy. I'm gratified that much of this modern explosion of ideas, information, and people to assist you with everything from conquering procrastination to shaving strokes off your golf score appears to be based on psychocybernetics. You might say that my original work was ahead of its time, or you might say that it has aged well. Whatever you conclude, the most important thing for you, personally, is that the fundamental promise of psychocybernetics has been proven true beyond any doubt or argument. That is, once difficult, now easy. Whatever is now difficult for you, whatever may have prompted your listening to this program, can be transformed from difficult to easy through the use of certain sound psychological concepts, easily understood and mastered mental training techniques, and a few practical steps. Your secret blueprint. I would argue that the most important psychological discovery of modern times is the discovery of the self-image. By understanding your self-image, and by learning to modify it and manage it to suit your purposes, you gain incredible confidence and power. Whether we realize it or not, each of us carries within us a mental blueprint or picture of ourselves. It may be vague and ill-defined to our conscious gaze. In fact, it may not be consciously recognizable at all, but it is there, complete, down to the last detail. This self-image is our own conception of the sort of person I am. It has been built up from our own beliefs about ourselves. Most of these beliefs about ourselves have unconsciously been formed from our past experiences, our successes and failures, our humiliations, our triumphs, and the way other people have reacted to us, especially in early childhood. From all these, we mentally construct a self, or a picture of a self. Once an idea or a belief about ourselves goes into this picture, it becomes truth, as far as we personally are concerned. We do not question its validity, but proceed to act upon it just as if it were true. The self-image then controls what you can and cannot accomplish, what is difficult or easy for you, even how others respond to you. Just as certainly and scientifically as a thermostat controls the temperature in your home. Specifically, all your actions, feelings, behavior, even your abilities, are always consistent with this self-image. Note the word always. In short, you will act like the sort of person you conceive yourself to be. More important, you literally cannot act otherwise, in spite of all your conscious efforts or willpower. This is why trying to achieve something difficult with teeth gritted is a losing battle. Willpower is not the answer. Self-image management is. The snapback effect. The person who has a fat self-image, whose self-image claims to have a sweet tooth, to be unable to resist junk food, who cannot find the time to exercise, will be unable to lose weight and keep it off no matter what he tries to do consciously in opposition to that self-image. You cannot long outperform or escape your self-image. If you do escape briefly, you'll be snapped back, like a rubber band extended between two fingers coming loose from one. The person who perceives himself to be a failure-type person will find some way to fail, in spite of all his good intentions or his willpower, even if opportunity is literally dumped in his lap. The person who conceives himself to be a victim of injustice, one who was meant to suffer, will invariably find circumstances to verify his opinions. You can insert any specific into this: your golf game, sales career, public speaking, weight loss, relationships. The control of your self-image is absolute and pervasive. The snapback effect is universal. The self-image is a premise, a base or a foundation upon which your entire personality, your behavior, and even your circumstances are built. As a result, our experiences seem to verify and thereby strengthen our self-images, and either a vicious or a beneficent cycle, as the case may be, is set up. For example, a student who sees himself as an F-type student, or one who is dumb in mathematics, will invariably find that his report card bears him out. He then has proof. In the same manner, a sales professional or an entrepreneur will also find that her actual experiences tend to prove that her self-image is correct. Whatever is difficult for you, whatever frustrations you have in your life, they are likely proving and reinforcing something ingrained in your self-image like a groove in a record. Because of this objective proof, it very seldom occurs to us that our trouble lies in our self-image or our own evaluation of ourselves. Tell the student that he only thinks he cannot master algebra, and he'll doubt your sanity. He has tried and tried, and still his report card tells the story. Tell the sales agent that it's only an idea that she cannot earn more than a certain figure, and she can prove you wrong by her order book. She knows only too well how hard she has tried and failed. Yet, as we shall see, almost miraculous changes have occurred, both in grades of students and the earning capacity of salespeople, once they were prevailed upon to change their self-images. Obviously, it's not enough to say, "It's all in your head." In fact, that's insulting. It is more productive to explain that it is based on certain ingrained, possibly hidden patterns of thought that, if altered, will free you to tap more of your potential and experience vastly different results. This brings me to the most important truth about the self-image. It can be changed. Numerous case histories have shown that you are never too young or too old to change your self-image and start to live a new, amazingly different life. Here is another illustration of how the self-image operates. Picture yourself living inside two boxes, one smaller than the other. The bigger box, farthest away from you, represents real or realistic limits. The box within, the smaller one that is tightly confining yourself, represents self-imposed limits. The area between the two boxes is your area or range of underutilized potential. As you discover the means of strengthening and liberating your self-image, you expand the smaller box, bringing it closer to the size of the larger one, permitting greater use of your true potential. Success from the inside out, not the outside in. One of the reasons it seems so difficult for a person to change habits, personality, or a way of life has been that nearly all efforts at change have been directed to the circumference of the self, so to speak, rather than to the center. Numerous patients have said to me something like the following: "If you're talking about positive thinking, I've tried that before and it just doesn't work for me." However, a little questioning invariably brings out that these individuals employed positive thinking or attempted to employ it either on particular external circumstances or on some particular habit or character defect. "I will get that job. I will be more calm and relaxed in the future. This business venture will turn out right for me," and so on. But they never thought to change their thinking of the self that was to accomplish these things. Jesus warned us about the folly of putting a patch of new material on an old garment or of putting new wine into old bottles. Positive thinking cannot be used effectively as a patch to the same old self-image. In fact, it is literally impossible to really think positively about a particular situation as long as you hold a negative concept of self. Numerous experiments have shown that once the concept of self is changed, other things consistent with the new concept of self are accomplished easily and without strain. A system of ideas. One of the earliest and most convincing experiments along this line was conducted by the late Prescott Lecky, one of the pioneers in self-image psychology. Leckie conceived of the personality as a system of ideas, all of which must be consistent with each other. Ideas that are inconsistent with the system are rejected, not believed, and not acted on. Ideas that seem to be consistent with the system are accepted. At the very center of this system of ideas, the keystone or the base on which all else is built is the individual's self-image or his conception of himself. Leckie was a schoolteacher and had an opportunity to test his theory on thousands of students. He theorized that if a student had trouble learning a certain subject, it could be because, from the student's point of view, it would be inconsistent for him to learn it. Leckie believed, however, that if the student could be induced to change his self-definition, his learning ability should also change. This proved to be the case. One student, who misspelled 55 words out of 100 and flunked so many subjects that he lost credit for a year, made a general average of 91 the next year and became one of the best spellers in school. A girl who was dropped from one college because of poor grades entered Columbia and became a straight A student. A boy who was told by a testing bureau that he had no aptitude for English won honorable mention the next year for a literary prize. The trouble with these students was not that they were dumb or lacking in basic aptitudes. The trouble was an inadequate self-image. I don't have a mathematical mind. I'm just naturally a poor speller. They identified with their mistakes and failures. Instead of saying, "I failed that test," which is factual and descriptive, they concluded, "I am a failure." Instead of saying, "I flunked that subject," they said, "I am a flunkout." For those who are interested in learning more of Leckie's work, try to find a copy of his book, Self-Consistency, A Theory of Personality. Leckie also used the same method to cure students of such habits as nail-biting and stuttering. My own files contain case histories just as convincing. The woman who was so afraid of strangers that she seldom ventured out of the house, and who now makes her living as a public speaker. The salesman, who had already prepared a letter of resignation because he just wasn't cut out for selling, and 6 months later was number one man on a force of 100 salespeople. The minister who was considering retirement because nerves and the pressure of preparing a sermon every week were getting him down, and who now delivers an average of 3 outside talks a week in addition to his weekly sermons and doesn't know he has a nerve in his body. Following Dr. Leckie's breakthrough thinking on this subject, born from observation, as well as my own observations and thoughts chronicled in the earlier editions of this book, a mountain of more sophisticated scientific research and anecdotal evidence has led to the acceptance of the controlling self-image by most of the academic psychological community. How a plastic surgeon became interested in self-image psychology. My story. Offhand, there would seem to be little or no connection between surgery and psychology. Yet it was the work of the plastic surgeon that first hinted at the existence of the self-image and raised certain questions that led to important psychological knowledge. When I first began the practice of plastic surgery many years ago, I was amazed by the dramatic and sudden changes in character and personality that often resulted when a facial defect was corrected. Changing the physical image in many instances appeared to create an entirely new person. In case after case, the scalpel that I held in my hand became a magic wand that transformed not only patients' appearance, but their whole life. The shy and retiring became bold and courageous. A stupid boy changed into an alert, bright youngster who went on to become an executive with a prominent firm. A salesman who had lost his touch and his faith in himself became a model of self-confidence. And perhaps the most startling of all was the habitual hardened criminal who changed almost overnight from an incorrigible who had never shown any desire to change into a model prisoner who won a parole and went on to assume a responsible role in society. Some 60 years ago, I reported many such case histories in my book New Faces, New Futures, written more for my peers than the public. Following its publication and similar articles in leading magazines, I was besieged with questions by criminologists, psychologists, sociologists, and psychiatrists. They asked questions that I could not answer, but they did start me on a search. Strangely enough, I learned as much from my failures as from my successes, if not more. It was easy to explain the successes. The boy with the two big ears, who had been told that he looked like a taxicab with both doors open, had been ridiculed all his life, often cruelly. Association with others meant humiliation and pain. Why shouldn't he avoid social contacts? Why shouldn't he become afraid of people and retire into himself? Terribly afraid to express himself in any way, he became known as stupid. When his ears were corrected, it would seem only natural that since the cause of his embarrassment and humiliation had been removed, he should assume a normal role in life, which he did. Or consider the salesman who suffered a facial disfigurement as the result of an automobile accident. Each morning when he shaved, he could see the horrible disfiguring scar on his cheek and the grotesque twist to his mouth. For the first time in his life, he became painfully self-conscious. He was ashamed of himself and felt that his appearance must be repulsive to others. The scar became an obsession with him. He was different from other people. He began to wonder what others were thinking of him. Soon his self-image was even more mutilated than his face. He began to lose confidence in himself. He became bitter and hostile. Soon, almost all his attention was directed toward himself, and his primary goal became the protection of his ego and the avoidance of situations that might bring humiliation. It is easy to understand how the correction of his facial disfigurement and the restoration of a normal face would overnight change this man's entire attitude and outlook, his feelings about himself, resulting in greater success in his work. The mystery inspired me. If the scalpel was magic, why did some people who acquired new faces go right on wearing their old personalities? What about the exceptions, those who didn't change? What about the Duchess, who all her life had been terribly shy and self-conscious because of a tremendous hump in her nose? Although surgery gave her a classic nose and a face that was truly beautiful, she continued to act the part of the ugly duckling, the unwanted sister who could never bring herself to look another human being in the eye. If the scalpel itself was magic, why did it not work on the Duchess? Or what about all the others who acquired new faces but went right on wearing the same old personality? How to explain the reaction of people who insist that the surgery has made no difference whatever in their appearance? Every plastic surgeon has had this experience and has probably been as baffled by it as I was. No matter how drastic the change in appearance may be, certain patients will insist that, "I look just the same as before, you didn't do a thing." Friends, even family, may scarcely recognize them, may become enthusiastic over their newly acquired beauty, yet the patients themselves insist that they can see only slight or no improvement, or in fact deny that any change at all has been made. Comparison of before and after photographs does little good and may even arouse hostility. By some strange mental alchemy, the patient will rationalize, "Of course, I can see that the hump is no longer in my nose, but my nose still looks just the same." Or, "The scar may not show anymore, but it's still there." Scars that bring pride instead of shame. Still another clue in search of the elusive self-image is the fact that not all scars or disfigurements bring shame and humiliation. When I was a young medical student in Germany, I saw many a student proudly wearing his saber scar, much as an American might wear the Medal of Honor. The duelists were the elite of college society, and a facial scar was the badge that proved you a member in good standing. To these boys, the acquisition of a horrible scar on the cheek had the same psychological effect as the eradication of the scar from the cheek of my salesman patient. I began to see that a knife itself held no magical powers. It could be used on one person to inflict a scar and on another to erase a scar with the same psychological results. The mystery of imaginary ugliness. To a person handicapped by a genuine congenital defect or suffering an actual facial disfigurement as a result of an accident, plastic surgery can indeed seemingly perform magic. From such cases, it would be easy to theorize that the cure-all for all neuroses, unhappiness, failure, fear, anxiety, and lack of self-confidence, would be wholesale plastic surgery to remove all bodily defects. However, according to this theory, persons with normal or acceptable faces should be singularly free from all psychological handicaps. They should be cheerful, happy, self-confident, free from anxiety and worry. We know only too well this is not true. Nor can such a theory explain the people who visit the office of a cosmetic surgeon and demand a facelift to cure a purely imaginary ugliness. There are, for example, the 35 to 45-year-old women who are convinced that they look old, even though their appearance is perfectly normal, and in many cases unusually attractive. There are the young girls who are convinced that they are ugly merely because their mouth, nose, or bust measurement does not exactly match that of the current reigning Hollywood celebrity, teen pop star, or the most popular girl in their school. There are the men who believe that their ears are too big or their noses too long. Such imagined ugliness is not at all uncommon. Surveys of everyone from teenagers and college students to mature men and women consistently show high numbers, 70, 80, even 90%, dissatisfied in some way with their appearance. If the words normal or average mean anything at all, it is obvious that 90% of our population cannot be abnormal or different or defective in appearance. Yet surveys have shown that approximately the same percentage of our general population finds some reason to be ashamed of their body image. Of course, in some cases, this becomes constructive dissatisfaction that motivates healthy weight loss and exercise. Many other times, though, it either stimulates attempts at weight loss or fitness doomed to failure because of strong self-image-based restrictions, or simply cause people profound unhappiness. These people react just as if they suffered an actual disfigurement. They feel the same shame. They develop the same fears and anxieties. Their capacity to really live fully is blocked and choked by the same sort of psychological roadblocks. Their scars, though mental and emotional rather than physical, are just as debilitating. Why are the rich and powerful unhappy? Why do the popular, successful, wealthy, beautiful people of Hollywood, athletes awarded mega-million-dollar contracts and set for life, and enormously influential and powerful business or political leaders, engage in amazingly unhappy and self-sabotaging acts of alcohol or drug abuse and addiction, or in all manner of publicly humiliating and destructive behavior? You see it reported every day. They've bought the BMW and they had the $3 million Mill Valley house and they still wake up in the morning and say, "I don't feel good about myself." That's a quote from Dr. Stephen Goldbart, a psychologist treating many dot-com and tech industry millionaires in Silicon Valley for what is characterized as undeserved wealth syndrome. Wealth, success, power, and celebrity are no more guarantees of happiness and peace of mind than surgical improvement of some personal appearance flaw. The self-image, the real secret. Discovery of the self-image explains all the apparent discrepancies we've been discussing. It is the common denominator, the determining factor in all our case histories, the failures as well as the successes. The secret is this: to really live, that is, to find life reasonably satisfying, you must have an adequate and realistic self-image that you can live with. You must find yourself acceptable to you. You must have a wholesome self-esteem. You must have a self that you can trust and believe in. You must have a self that you are not ashamed to be, and one that you can feel free to express creatively, rather than hide or cover up. You must know yourself, both your strengths and your weaknesses, and be honest with yourself concerning both. Your self-image must be a reasonable approximation of you, being neither more nor less than you are. When this self-image is intact and secure, you feel good. When it is threatened, you feel anxious and insecure. When it is adequate, and one that you can be wholesomely proud of, you feel self-confident. You feel free to be yourself and to express yourself. You function at your optimum. When the self-image is an object of shame, you attempt to hide it rather than express it. Creative expression is blocked. You become hostile and hard to get along with. If a scar on the face enhances the self-image, as in the case of the German duelist, self-esteem and self-confidence are increased. If a scar on the face detracts from the self-image, as in the case of the salesman, loss of self-esteem and self-confidence result. When a facial disfigurement is corrected by plastic surgery, dramatic psychological changes result only if there is a corresponding correction of the mutilated self-image. Sometimes the image of a disfigured self persists even after successful surgery, much the same as the phantom limb may continue to feel pain years after the physical arm or leg has been amputated. I begin a new career. These observations led me into a new career. In 1945 or so, I became definitely convinced that many of the people who consult a plastic surgeon need more than surgery, and that some do not need surgery at all. If I were to treat these people as patients, as a whole person, rather than as merely a nose, ear, mouth, arm, or leg, I needed to be in a position to give them something more. I needed to be able to show them how to obtain a psychological, emotional, and spiritual facelift, how to remove emotional scars, how to channel their attitudes and thoughts as well as modify their physical appearance. This determination launched me on a continuing process of pointed observation, documenting my own case histories, lecturing both to peers and to the public, then writing this book, first published in 1960. This book caught the public's imagination in a special way. It was excerpted in popular magazines, including Reader's Digest and Cosmopolitan, purchased by the thousands by corporations for their salespeople and other employees, adopted by top athletes, coaches, and teams, including the Vince Lombardi-coached Green Bay Packers. Its success led quickly to many speaking engagements, seminar tours, radio and television interviews, even my own radio program. Invitations to speak about my discoveries came from churches, colleges, and corporations. Ultimately, I also wrote several other books, extensions of this one, including The Magic Power of Self-Image. Late in my life, 3 decades after its first publication, I was gratified that Psycho-Cybernetics continues to sell tens of thousands of copies each year, almost entirely thanks to word-of-mouth recommendations, and is inspiring new interpretations. With each passing year, as I accumulated more experience teaching the power of self-image, counseling, and monitoring the results people achieved with this information, I became more convinced than ever that what each of us really wants, deep down, is more life. Something I termed aliveness, the experience of living a life unrestricted by self-image imposed artificial limits. Happiness, success, peace of mind, whatever your own conception of supreme good may be, is experienced in its essence as more life. When we experience expansive emotions of happiness, self-confidence, and success, we enjoy more life. And to the degree that we inhibit our abilities, frustrate our God-given talents, and allow ourselves to suffer anxiety, fear, self-condemnation, and self-hate, we literally choke off the life force available to us and turn our back on the gift that our Creator has made. To the degree that we deny the gift of life, we embrace death. Your new program for liberated living. In my opinion, the professions of psychology and psychiatry are often far too pessimistic regarding people and their potential for self-directed change, even greatness. Since psychologists and psychiatrists deal with so-called abnormal people, the literature is almost exclusively taken up with various abnormalities, with some people's tendencies towards self-destruction. Many people, I am afraid, have read so much of this type of viewpoint that they've come to regard such things as hatred, the destructive instinct, guilt, self-condemnation, and all the other negatives as normal human behavior. Average persons feel awfully weak and impotent when they think of the prospect of pitting their puny will against these negative forces in human nature in order to gain health and happiness. If this were a true picture of human nature and the human condition, self-improvement would indeed be a rather futile thing. However, I believe, and the experiences of my many patients have confirmed the fact, that you do not have to do the job alone. There is within each of us a life instinct, which is forever working toward health, happiness, and all that makes for more life for the individual. This life instinct works for you through what I call the creative mechanism, or when used correctly, the automatic success mechanism that is built into each human being. In this program, I will endeavor to give you very practical ideas and instructions for liberating your own self-image, fully activating your own automatic success mechanism. If you will give all this a reasonable chance, I'm confident you too will be pleasantly amazed at all the positive changes you will experience. New scientific insights into the subconscious mind. There is admittedly debate about the actual structural makeup of the human mind. Crammed into your brain are more neurons than there are stars in the Milky Way, hundreds of billions of them, an unimaginable number. Each of these neurons receives input from tens of thousands of the other neurons and sends messages to tens of thousands of others, adding up to over 1 million billion connections. In his book about the brain, Bright Air, Brilliant Fire, neuroscientist Gerald Edelman speculated that if you were to attempt counting the links one per second, you might finish 32 million years later. The operation is something roughly akin to your clicking on the You've Got Mail beeping icon on your computer and finding 10,000 or 20,000 email messages that require sorting, prioritizing, organizing, and responding to just to get everything right so that you can accomplish the first simple task of your day, such as tying your shoelaces. You would melt down at the prospect, but your brain handles it in nanoseconds with aplomb. The brain is roughly 3 pounds. yet it contains the equivalent of entire cities full of giant buildings full of computer circuitry. It is surely the most complex and amazing thing we will ever discover, and it is still a frontier, because research keeps uncovering new revelations about how the human mind operates. On top of the mechanical aspects, there are psychological and spiritual matters, the issue of mind as the pathway to the soul, the conscious and subconscious, the Freudian concept of id, the idea of three operating systems rather than two, reptilian, limbic, and cerebral, left brain, right brain, and on and on. My take on all this has been criticized by some as simplistic. It's possible that research continuing long after my departure will eventually demonstrate that I've been partly right and partly wrong, and will produce even better insights into practical self-improvement. If and when that occurs, I'd applaud. But for now, let me just say that to you, it shouldn't matter much whether some professor of psychology with lots of letters after his name looks down his nose at what we are discussing as oversimplistic. Let's you and I focus on the most important point: what works. And I can assure you that what we are discussing here has worked for thousands and thousands and thousands of people, and will work for you. By work, I mean empower you to get more of what you want out of life. My exploration of the science of cybernetics convinced me that the so-called subconscious mind is not a mind at all, but a goal-striving servo mechanism consisting of the brain and nervous system, which is used and directed by the mind. The most usable concept is that man does not have two minds, but rather a mind, or consciousness, which operates an automatic goal-striving machine. This automatic goal-striving machine functions in much the same way as electronic servo mechanisms function, but it is much more marvelous, much more complex than any electronic brain, computer, or guided missile ever conceived by man. The creative mechanism within you is impersonal. It will work automatically and impersonally to achieve goals of success and happiness, or unhappiness and failure, depending upon the goals you set for it. Present it with success goals, and it functions as a success mechanism. Present it with negative goals, and it operates just as impersonally and just as faithfully as a failure mechanism. Like any other servo mechanism, it must have a clear-cut target, objective, or problem to work upon. In short, the goals you attempt to convey to this mechanism are filtered through the self-image, and if they are inconsistent with the self-image, they are rejected or modified. By discovering how to alter your self-image, you end its conflict with your goals. Then, if you can communicate your goals directly to your creative mechanism, it will do what is necessary for you to achieve them. Like any other servo mechanism, our creative mechanism uses the information and the data that we feed into it, our thoughts, beliefs, interpretations. Through our attitudes and interpretations of situations, we describe the problem to be worked on. If we feed information and data into our creative mechanism to the effect that we ourselves are unworthy, inferior, undeserving, incapable, our negative self-image, this data is processed and acted on as any other data in giving us the answer in the form of objective experience. When someone we know acts, or when we behave in a way that is astoundingly wrong and wonder why, the answer is basically miscommunication with the servo mechanism. The servo mechanism is functioning perfectly, but acting on a severe misunderstanding. In the excellent book, Battling the Inner Dummy, The Craziness of Apparently Normal People, David Weiner and Dr. Gilbert Hefter state, "It is apparent that even the most civilized among us have an inner craziness, a potential for irrationality with which we must contend." Unquote. The computer jargon usually used by computer experts shrugging their shoulders at some wild malfunction is GIGO: garbage in, garbage out. In other words, if neuron channels process enough garbage and link together in a certain way, the outcome or output is garbage behavior. Like any other servo mechanism, Our creative mechanism makes use of stored information, or memory, in solving current problems and responding to current situations. Sometimes this stored data can remain in control long after any truth or usefulness has evaporated. Again, quoting from Battling the Inner Dummy, this example: "You are no good. You will never amount to anything," we might be told by our father at the age of 10 after we just failed a math quiz in school. This is the kind of statement that might become a limbic memory within our id, our inner dummy, and remain with us for years, if not for a lifetime. Unquote. The reason it would remain with us rather than just bounce off like water off a duck's back is what they call limbic memory, or what I view only slightly differently as self-image imprinting. This is most controlled by three factors: authoritative source, intensity, and repetition. What we hear from a source we accept as authoritative, such as the father we see as omnipotent, from whom we desperately seek acceptance as a child, is given far more weight than the same statements if heard from what is to us at the time a less credible source. What we see, hear, or experience with intensity, such as the father yelling it at us in front of others, making us humiliated, has added weight. And what we hear repetitively from authoritative sources has even more weight. Years after this programming has ceased, it may still be governing all sorts of behavior because the servo mechanism continues acting upon it as current. Your program for more liberated living consists in, first of all, learning something about this creative mechanism or automatic guidance system within you. In the process, you will learn how to use it as a success mechanism rather than as a failure mechanism. Second, you will actually program and reprogram or engineer the personality and the life experiences you desire. It is not widely known, but the controversial Dr. Timothy Leary, a 1960s hippie icon but also a scientist, was as fascinated with the link between mechanical cybernetics and the workings of the human mind as I. In an interview in 1992, Leary stated, "It is a genetic imperative to explore the brain, because it's there. If you're carrying around in your head 100 billion mainframe computers, you just have to get in there and learn how to operate them." Unquote. I think it is your personal imperative to invest the time, energy, and study needed to better understand and use your mind power, including your self-image power. He also said, "We can only understand our inner workings in terms of the external mechanical or teleological models that we build." Unquote. This program, now in your hands, is exactly that. A path to greater understanding of your own mind based on teleological models such as guided missile and computer technologies. The method itself consists in learning, practicing, and experiencing new habits of thinking, imagining, remembering, and acting in order to, 1, develop an adequate and realistic self-image, and 2, use your creative mechanism to bring success and happiness in achieving particular goals. While the human mind is an endlessly complex creation, and while you could read hundreds of texts by neuroscientists and be no further along in improving your use of your own mind, self-improvement with psychocybernetics can be remarkably simple, and it offers rapid results. If you can remember, worry, or tie your shoe, you can succeed with psychocybernetics. As you will see later, the method to be used consists of creative mental picturing, creatively experiencing through your imagination, and the formation of new automatic reaction patterns by acting out and acting as if. You may already have read or heard quite a bit about such techniques and tried them with mixed or disappointing results. If so, it does not necessarily mean that you used them improperly, nor does it mean that you are somehow unable to use them successfully. It more likely means that you attempted applying the techniques in conflict with your self-image. Once you use them in concert with modifying, managing, and strengthening your self-image, you will see positive results. I often told my patients that if you can remember, worry, or tie your shoe, you will have no trouble applying this method. The things you are called upon to do are simple, but you must practice and experience. Visualizing, creative mental picturing, is no more difficult than what you do when you remember a scene out of the past or worry about the future. Acting out new action patterns is no more difficult than deciding, than following through on tying your shoes in a new and different manner each morning, instead of continuing to tie them in your old habitual way without thought or decision. All those who have benefited from psychocybernetics. You might be encouraged by a quick list of those who use these methods exactly as I'm going to describe them to you as we proceed through this program. Athletes. Psychocybernetics and athletes have long been linked. In 1967, the newspapers reported that the big thing now with the Green Bay Packers is psychocybernetics. This was the Vince Lombardi era Packers, and Coach Lombardi, as well as famous players Jerry Kramer and Bart Starr, all carried their copies of the book with them and shared it with their teammates. A New York Times article from July 1968 reported on Yankee great Mickey Mantle uncovering Jim Booten's copy of Psychocybernetics and finding it full of handwritten margin notes. Jack Nicklaus, the late Payne Stewart, and many other top golfers have made very specific statements about their reliance on the mental side of golf. In a foreword to the book Mind Over Golf, referring to his victories in the 1989 PGA Championship and the 1991 U.S. Open, Payne Stewart wrote, "With my old mindset, I don't think I would have been able to prevail in either of those major championships. But with my new mental approach, I was able to raise my game to the highest level when I had to." Unquote. Mind Over Golf, incidentally, is written by Dr. Richard Koop, a professor of educational psychology at the University of North Carolina, a contributing editor to Golf Magazine, and a coach to many golfers. I recommend his book as a companion to this one, Should Golf Be Your Recreation or Vocation? In this program, you will also discover rodeo riders, Olympic athletes, football players, and many coaches who rely on psychocybernetic strategies in general, or specifically by name, to succeed. Coaches. In 1997, the Psychocybernetics Foundation received a letter from Linda Tyler Rollins, Assistant Athletic Director for Academic Affairs at the University of North Texas. She wrote that she had been teaching from psychocybernetics for years and that in a course for incoming scholarship athletes, quote, "the vocabulary they become accustomed to during their academic and athletic careers at UNT is based on the concepts presented by Dr. Maltz before these students were born," unquote. A Boston psychologist, now coaching pro golfers profiled in Golf Magazine, Dr. Gloria Spitalny, says, "By my calculations, the average golfer spends about 86% of their time doing nothing but wrestling with their thoughts and emotions, feeling one way or another about what is taking place, feeling exhilaration or anger, struggling to keep focused, worrying about what's happened or what is up ahead." Unquote. It only stands to reason that if 86% of the time spent playing the game is dominated by thought and emotion, not physical action, that 86% of the success-failure determination is due to management of thoughts and emotions, not swing mechanics or putting prowess. The same thing is true in every athletic activity. So more and more coaches are devoting more and more time and energy to mental preparation and psychological motivation. Several top coaches have written their own books about these subjects, notably including Pat Riley and Phil Jackson of the NBA. Brendan Suhr, former assistant head coach with Chuck Daly at the Detroit Pistons and the Orlando Magic, is a fan of psychocybernetics and, in a video program about psychocybernetics, explained that he used the principles in suggesting new mental pictures to players struggling with different aspects of the game. Entrepreneurs and business leaders. Consider Ray Kroc, the milkshake machine salesman who looked at the McDonald Brothers Little Hamburger stand and envisioned something amazing. Long after McDonald's hamburger shops were everywhere, Mr. Kroc was asked in an interview how he felt about the tendency of competitive fast food restaurant chains to copy every new McDonald's idea, product, or promotion so quickly. He replied, "We can invent faster than they can copy." He was making a statement of self-image, an affirmation of confidence, initiative, and power, in regard to a set of circumstances that many people would complain about and feel threatened by. Every business visionary and leader of note has a similar bring it on approach, which from a psychocybernetic standpoint, I admire. Let me tell you one quick story about a remarkable young business leader by the name of Joe Polish. Joe is a carpet cleaner by trade who discovered certain effective, albeit unorthodox, methods for marketing and promoting such a business, and used that as a springboard to develop a company that teaches and assists other carpet cleaners with their marketing. At last count, Joe's organization had nearly 4,000 carpet cleaners as members from all over the United States and several foreign countries, with combined sales of over $800 million in cleaning services and products each year. Several hundred of those carpet cleaning business owners belong to Joe's telephone coaching program, too. Joe is a young man who has risen above a difficult family background without a college education and with no formal education in marketing to become the leading figure in his entire industry. In fact, he was named the Person of the Year by the number one industry trade journal. Joe says that he has worn out his copy of Psycho-Cybernetics and recommends it to all his members, and has even held a special seminar for his members built around Psycho-Cybernetics with the editor of this book as a guest speaker. The reason? As Joe says, all the business and marketing knowledge and technical skills in the world, coupled with the best products, prices, and positioning, are of far less value than they should be if the person who possesses them lacks the inner confidence needed to use them. One of the things we teach is how to sell at prices higher than your competition, and that has more to do with the individual business owner's self-image than it does with anything else. Unquote. Sales professionals. Bill Brooks, a founding member of the board of the Psycho-Cybernetics Foundation, has devised complex and sophisticated sales training systems for sales forces of some of America's biggest corporations. His high-impact sales system has been the subject of several very fine books, including You're Working Too Hard to Make a Living. Bill has succeeded personally as a salesman and assisted thousands of others. And while he is very focused on methodology, he freely admits that the most sophisticated, perfectly engineered system for selling cannot produce results in the hands of salespersons attempting to function in conflict and combat with their own self-images. Zig Ziglar is arguably America's most celebrated motivational speaker and sales trainer. In his book, Secrets of Closing the Sale, which has sold well over 250,000 copies, Zig writes, "The salesman's self-image has a direct bearing on his sales success. When your self-image is solid, you can go from one prospect to the next, regardless of the reception you get. As a salesperson, it will help you enormously to understand that nobody on the face of this earth can make you feel inferior without your permission. Once you get your image right, then your sales world and your personal world will improve." Dr. Maxwell Maltz, author of Psycho-Cybernetics, said the purpose of all psychotherapy is to build the self-esteem, that is, the image of the patient. Your self-image is important, so build a good one, and you'll be able to build your sales career bigger, better, and faster. Unquote. In this program, you'll be privy to a handful of case histories involving sales professionals, including the man with the too big nose and too big ears. You will see that Psycho-Cybernetics crosses all occupational, vocational, educational, or situational borders to work almost as reliably and consistently as gravity. Chapter 16 of this program features 5 amazing stories of individuals' successes with Psycho-Cybernetics. But what about genetics or natural talent? The argument of genetic predestination is utterly without merit. Bunk. In his outstanding book, Profiles of Power and Success, Dr. Gene Lundrum provides in-depth analytical psychological profiles of 14 extraordinarily successful visionaries and achievers and flatly concludes that nurture, not nature, is the basis for success. Quote, "Based on the family histories of these visionaries, heritage had little or nothing to do with their success." Unquote. Instead, he identifies certain characteristics with which he says they were programmed, and they programmed themselves. If genetic talent were the barrier to success you cannot overcome, or the ultimate secret behind achievement, you would expect Walt Disney to have come from breeding stock, evidencing extraordinary creativity and entrepreneurial accomplishment. Walt Disney's father failed in 5 different businesses, including a Florida motel. Master architect Frank Lloyd Wright's sire was an unemployed itinerant minister, so inept he never kept any one job for more than a year. Picasso's father was a mediocre artist at best. No, this isn't like breeding horses or show dogs. Evidence abounds that the conditioned, programmed, nurtured, and directed self-image controls success, not a genetic transfer over which you have no control. You cannot select your parents. You can select your self-image with Psycho-Cybernetics. Someone can argue this by pointing a finger at Michael Jordan or Tiger Woods. While it is true they each exhibit exceptional raw physical talent, That talent alone would surely have gone to waste without the healthy self-image conditioned through a variety of influences, not the least of which were authoritative sources, such as Tiger's father or Michael's college coach, Dean Smith. And for every Jordan, I can point my finger to an athlete of admittedly average physical talent who rises to the very top of his sport. In baseball, Ty Cobb and Pete Rose come to mind. In football, Fran Tarkenton or Doug Flutie, both erroneously judged by the experts as too small to play the game, are examples. Do not tolerate for a minute the idea that you are prohibited from any achievement by the absence of inborn talent or ability. This is a lie of the grandest order, an excuse of the saddest kind. Here's a prescription to help you along. Begin collecting scrapbooks on persons, past or present, who exhibit both the qualities of character and personality and the life achievements to which you aspire. Select a different representative for each characteristic, each aspiration. Become the reigning expert in these people's lives by collecting and reading their biographies, autobiographies, articles about them, speeches made by them, others' analyses of them that can be found in books like Dr. Lundrum's, Napoleon Hill's, and others. Discover the almost universal absence of predisposition from genetics, and often from their early environment and upbringing, for the personality they developed and the accomplishments of their lives. Ferret out the forces, thoughts, and influences that actually shaped them. By making this your hobby, you will feed your imagination with valuable raw material that it can utilize to build the stronger, more goal-oriented self-image you require to achieve your life aspirations. In Mind Over Golf, Richard Koop tells golfers, "If you've attended a PGA or LPGA tour event and found your own swing seemed to contain a little more rhythm and tempo than usual the next time you played, it was no accident." By watching the tour professionals swing their clubs with proper pace, you were able to absorb some of their talent, and it showed in your game. This is common for many golfers of all talent levels. Even the most disjointed golfer begins to look rhythmical after observing smooth swingers such as Marco Mira, Gene Littler, or Nancy Lopez. The problem is that the newfound tempo doesn't last very long unless you're able to reinforce your visualization by regularly watching the tour pros, unquote. This is exactly what I'm suggesting you do. Watch the people who best exemplify the characteristics you wish to strengthen and who are living as you aspire to live by studying them through every media and source available. Try this mental training exercise. Pick someone to thoroughly study for a month, to get so intimately familiar with the way he or she thinks that you can sit down and have a conversation with the person and solicit advice and coaching in your imagination.
Thank you for listening to this episode of our podcast. We'll be really thankful if you support us by clicking the link in the description so that we continue to create amazing content for you.